Welcome to the Hospice News Elevate podcast. I'm Jim Parker, senior editor of Hospice News, and with me today is Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter, founder of the End Well Project. And we're going to be talking about the ways that pop culture can influence people's behavior at the end of life, as well as their care decisions. Shoshana, thanks so much for being here. So I wondered if you could start by introducing us to End Well and the work you're doing there.
Yeah, End Well is really about shifting how we as a culture relate to the end of life. And I think at its core, it's a movement that is grounded in the belief that how we think about mortality, how we think about death and dying can shape how we live. And if we can change the conversation, we can change the experience for people and families everywhere. And the work itself happens in a few pretty interconnected ways. And one is through convening. And so we bring together people from across disciplines, clinicians, caregivers, researchers, artists, patients, storytellers, folks from policy, because I very firmly believe that dying is not a medical issue, even though I'm a doctor. I think it's a human issue. And we believe that no single field can solve the challenges that we all face alone. So the gatherings, which is the End Well Summit happening in November every year in Los Angeles, they're about connection. They're about sparking new ideas and hopefully collaborations that can move this field forward. And then I think another piece is really community. We're building a space both in person as well as online and then through our social channels where people can engage with these topics more openly. And that's people navigating serious illness, caregivers, people who are clinically working in this space who just also want to feel more connected to each other. And I think there's a real hunger for connection and more of a shared language about this. And I think part of our role is helping meet people where they are. And then just finally, I will say, you know, media is a huge focus for us as an organization as well. So we have done some research to better understand how storytelling shapes perceptions and behaviors around death and dying. And then we've worked directly with creators and writers and producers to help bring more, hopefully, accurate and nuanced and human portrayals of end of life into television and film. Because I know that stories are often where people first encounter these ideas, and really it's all in service of creating a world where people feel more prepared, more supported, and hopefully empowered when it comes to the end of life.
Excellent. I've always respected and appreciated the work that End Well does, and your summits are just terrific events. So
Thank you.
Really appreciate your work. What led you to start End Well?
Yeah, I reflect on this a lot, you know, and I think it's only in hindsight where I can put the pieces all together. It really came from my experience as a physician. So early on in my residency, I was training in internal medicine. I was caring for patients who were very, very sick, often in the intensive care unit, and many of whom were near the end of their lives. And I was witnessing a profound disconnect between what the clinicians were imagining and orchestrating in terms of care and what patients and families and their other loved ones believed was going on. At least that was how I interpreted it. And we know from research that about 80% of people say they want to die in their own home, and around 30% actually do. And that gap isn't just about logistics. It's also about communication. It's about culture. It's about the fact that so many of us don't have the language and, frankly, the permission to talk about what matters most to us until it's often too late. So I was seeing patients with late-stage cancers, for example, end up in our ICU at the age of maybe 80 or 90, And really, they'd never had a conversation about prognosis with their oncologist, who maybe they'd known for 8 or 10 years, which blew my mind. And so we were, by default, treating their cancer, treating their problems very aggressively and invasively, even though for many of them, we weren't going to be able to cure their incurable disease. And it led to so much suffering and pain. And I, again, realized that, you know, as physicians, we didn't have the tools to be able to have these conversations, the space and the time. I was lucky in that I trained in an institution where we had a very robust palliative care team who could really artfully have discussions about goals of care and things like prognosis and discuss and sort of bridge the gap between the clinical team and the patients and their families to talk about how we could provide the best possible care based on what really mattered to the patient. So that was really early on my first exposure to this big issue, and finished training and realized I really wanted to do something about it. Endwell kind of came from this almost compulsion that I felt to create a space where we could bring these conversations out of the shadows and really begin to normalize them, not just clinically, but also culturally, since that's a big part of the conversation. And there's so many reasons, right, why healthcare does a terrible job of this stuff. I could probably talk for hours about that, but I will spare you. But certainly around the cultural taboos about talking about hard things was one area that I thought I could make a difference.
Excellent. Thank you. And well, as you mentioned briefly, recently did some research that looked at how some aspects of pop culture influence people's behavior regarding death and dying. Could you talk about some of the key findings of that research?
Yeah. I think what we found is both surprising and then in some ways very intuitive. Storytelling doesn't just shape awareness, it also shapes action. So in one of our studies, when people watched end-of-life storylines from shows like A Million Little Things, which has since wrapped, or the reality show The Gentle Art of Swedish Death Cleaning, they were significantly more likely to actually do something afterward. They were more likely to start conversations with loved ones, to reflect on their own wishes, to share important documents, even to begin the advanced care planning process. And this matters because we're living in a culture where around 90% of people say these conversations are important when we ask, but only about a quarter of them have actually had them. And I think what storytelling does is bridge that gap. It moves people from knowing something intellectually to feeling it emotionally, and that emotional resonance, that emotional connection is often what creates the momentum for change. So I will certainly send you our white papers that we published. They're on our endwellproject.org website. We did a very, very deep dive into a number of areas, but it's been really interesting over these last 3 years to embark on this research and see, you know, one of the ways that we can make a difference.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We also covered this on Hospice News in an article, but I really wanted to have a little longer conversation with you about it on our podcast. Yeah. Could you say more about the ways that pop culture influences behavior around end of life?
Yeah, I think pop culture is powerful because it doesn't feel like instruction or prescriptive. It feels like maybe participation. When we watch a story, we're not just observing. I think a lot of us imagine ourselves inside it. So research actually shows that people use these narratives almost like a kind of mental rehearsal of thinking through what they would do, what they might say, how they would respond if they or someone they love were in a similar situation. And that's where behavior, I think, begins to shift, because suddenly something that felt maybe abstract feels more personal. We also know narrative storytelling is more memorable and more believable. And as I mentioned before, more like emotionally resonant than traditional approaches of sharing information. So around end of life, you know, what we found is instead of avoiding the topic, people started to engage with it more. They started asking questions. They started imagining these conversations. And then the idea is they often, you know, and what we found is they actually have them.
And which television shows or other materials did the research examine? You mentioned a couple.
Yeah. So the research that we did looked at primetime television from a few different lenses. So we early on stepped back and we asked, like, what is television showing us about death overall, sort of more historically? And we partnered with the USC Annenberg Norman Lear Center to analyze a full 10 years of scripted TV and then also film. So from 2010 to 2020. And that included everything from medical dramas to crime shows to the more mainstream streaming series. And so we were sort of looking at patterns across the landscape. So shows that, like you'd imagine, Grey's Anatomy, Chicago Med, Criminal Minds, and The Resident came up really frequently in our analysis because, as you'd imagine, they often included death-related storylines. The analysis found that death on TV overwhelmingly portrayed violent things like shootings or murders, whereas death from illness were actually quite rare when that's not the reality of the situation. And when illness is shown, it's often treated more like a plot device rather than a lived experience. There's very little depiction of things like hospice, of palliative care, of patient-centered decision-making, the kinds of conversations that families actually need to have. So that was one layer of the research. We also found, and I will just, taking a step back, we also found that there wasn't diversity in these storylines in terms of, you know, ethnicity and various other elements of the conversations that people were having. Again, it was quite limited and not focused on, it was very often the doctor speaking to the patient without much back and forth. And then we also wanted to understand what happens when people actually watch more nuanced and human-centered stories about the end of life. So that was a year later. In that study, we looked specifically at two programs I mentioned earlier. One was A Million Little Things, particularly the series finale, which actually shows a character, follows this character over their cancer journey. They're navigating this terminal illness and making decisions about how they want to die and where they utilized medical aid in dying. And then the other was The Gentle Art of Swedish Death Cleaning, which was a reality show, which took a very different approach and followed someone with a serious illness diagnosis as she prepares for the end of her life through essentially cleaning out her stuff and the conversations and relationships and, again, going through her belongings. That was sort of the focus of the show. And I think what's important is that these shows are very, very different in tone and format. Obviously, A Million Little Things was a scripted drama and the other one was reality, but both grounded really beautifully, actually, in a real human experience. And they both created space for the kinds of conversations that we know are important in and around the end of life. So we could really, what we did in this particular study was we included control clips from those same shows, so we could really isolate the impact of the specific storylines. And that's what allowed us to see something that I think was really powerful, which is that it's not just television in general that matters, it's the kind of storytelling. I think when stories move beyond death as a plot point and actually reflect more of the emotional and the relational reality of dying, I think that's when we start to see shifts in how people think and what they do. So, you know, taken together, the research really looked both broadly at the cultural landscape of television and then more specifically how these particular shows could begin to change behavior.
That's really fascinating. Are you able to say what it was about these shows that spurred people to action?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a few elements that really stood out. And one is authenticity. We know that people respond when a story feels real, when it reflects the complexity of relationships and the messiness of decision-making. I think the emotional layers of what it's actually like and what it means to face the end of life, right? And I think another is that these stories made space for grief and for connection of the characters. In the research, the viewers described feeling everything from sadness to inspiration, and a sense of urgency. And they talked about love and regret and wanting to show up differently for the people in their lives. And then, interestingly, you may be surprised by this, but humor plays a role. When shows include moments of levity, it makes the topic feel more accessible. It reminds people that, I think even in the hardest moments, that life is still life and it's happening all around us, and it's okay to laugh when things are hard. So I think maybe the most important thing was that these stories show what's possible. They really modeled these conversations. They show people asking questions and really expressing their wishes and desires. And I think that modeling can be incredibly powerful and was really what we were hoping for when embarking on this whole project, was really to try to influence much more nuanced storytelling around these conversations.
And why is it so important that people have the kinds of conversations that these shows might indirectly or directly be encouraging?
Yeah, well, I think at a very practical level, these conversations are about trying to ensure that care aligns with what matters most to a person. Now, we can't always control that, but we can certainly strive. When people have talked about their wishes, we know families often feel less burdened. Decisions tend to be clearer. And care tends to reflect someone's values, right? So that's huge. There's also a deeper layer. I think when we don't talk about death, we tend to encounter it in crisis. And in those moments, there's often confusion and fear and a sense of just being overwhelmed and unprepared. And that can shape the entire experience, not just for the person in the bed, but for everyone around them. And research shows that when end-of-life preferences are really discussed and understood, families and loved ones have less anxiety, less depression, less distress afterward. So these conversations aren't just about planning, they're about care and connection. And I think in a broader sense, I feel very strongly that talking about mortality can actually change how we live every day throughout our lives, right? It can clarify what matters to us. It can deepen relationships. It can create a sense of intention about how we spend our time. So when we see things like TV beginning to open that door and normalize these conversations to make them feel possible and accessible, it's not just a cultural shift. I think it's also like a public health opportunity, right? I think it's a way of helping people live well all the way through to the end of life. And You know, it's been fascinating to me to see how over this last almost decade of Endwell, how this has all kind of come together. And we're so excited about the next chapter of what's to come in terms of how we can, I think, humanize these conversations to continue to create community and, you know, hopefully reach as many people as possible with these kinds of conversations.
Well, to say you have a busy schedule is an understatement. So I really appreciate you having this conversation with me today. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Jim.
Thank you so much for tuning into the Elevate podcast from Hospice News, a WTWH media publication. I hope you all take good care.